Book of Numbers, chapter 6. Numbers is a historical narrative. It describes Israel's history for almost the entire 40 years in the wilderness. From Exodus chapter 40, verse 2, and Numbers chapter 1, and verse 1, we learn that the book of Numbers begins a month after the tabernacle had been erected, which would be just a year and a month after the exodus from Egypt. So you get an idea of where the history starts. A key verse in the book of Numbers would be chapter 10, verse 29. We are journeying unto the place of which the Lord said, I will give it you. And that's true of us. So the thought of the book of Numbers is a pilgrimage. It is stressed, it is emphasized, submission to God, obedience to His will, service to the Lord. We like to read verses 1 through 12, Numbers chapter 6. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them, When either man or woman shall separate themselves to vow a vow of a Nazarite, to separate themselves unto the Lord, he shall separate himself from wine and strong drink, and shall drink no vinegar of wine or vinegar of strong drink. Neither shall he drink any liquor of grapes, nor eat moist grapes or dried. All the days of his separation shall he eat nothing that is made of the vine tree, from the kernels even to the husk. All the days of the vow of his separation there shall no razor come upon his head, until the days be fulfilled in the which he separateth himself unto the Lord. He shall be holy, and he shall let the locks of the hair of his head grow. All the days that he separateth himself unto the Lord, he shall come at no dead body. He shall not make himself unclean for his father, for his mother, for his brother, or for his sister, when they die, because the consecration of his God is upon his head. All the days of his separation he is holy unto the Lord, that is, he is set apart unto the Lord. And if any man die very suddenly by him, and he hath defiled the head of his consecration, then he shall shave his head in the day of his cleansing, on the seventh day shall he shave it. And on the eighth day he shall bring two turtles or two young pigeons to the priest to the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. And the priest shall offer the one for a sin offering, the other for a burnt offering, and make atonement for him, for that he sinned by the dead, and shall hallow his head that same day. And he shall consecrate unto the Lord the days of his separation, and shall bring a lamb of the first year for a trespass offering. But the days that were before shall be lost, because the separation was defiled. In verse 1, we see that the Lord is speaking to Moses. He's speaking that which Moses is to relay to Israel. We see that in verse 2. It is in this portion of Scripture that we are introduced to what is known as the Nazarite vow. In verse 2, we read those words, to vow a vow of a Nazarite. And our text gives us the details of this vow. Now, you and I are several thousand years removed from the Nazarite vow. And most people look at this and see absolutely no correlation to us today. But such thinking, of course, is erroneous. And though most consider the Old Testament to be irrelevant to today, That, of course, is not so. For it abounds with biblical principles. And we see these principles in this Nazirite vow. And we see that it's filled with many valuable lessons, much heart-searching instruction for God's people. There are many New Testament parallels to the Nazirite vow. So we want to speak tonight on the Nazirite vow, a picture of life for the Lord. A picture of life for the Lord. Like much of the Old Testament, it serves as a picture. A picture of our life. Our life for the Lord. The setting of what we just read really sets forth the moral order of the Christian life. If you read chapter 5, you'll see the subject of chapter 5 is cleansing for the child of God. The main theme of the verses that we just read is separation. Separation of the child of God. But then beginning with verse 13, reading through verse 21, you have instruction in worship. So you have cleansing, separation, worship. And then in verses 22 through 27, you have God's blessing upon this individual. And then in chapter 7 is all about serving the Lord. And all of that paints a picture. And the order is the order that we just mentioned is taught and illustrated all through the Word of God. Cleansing should lead to consecration or separation unto the Lord, which prepares one to worship the Lord. And the Lord blesses that individual. And now that individual is able and enabled to serve the Lord. So we're going to notice several things about this Nazirite vow. And again, it's a picture of a life for the Lord. First of all, what is involved here is a matter of great seriousness. And the Christian life is not a game. Christian life is a matter of great seriousness. The seriousness is seen in the fact that it's a vow. It is a vow. That is an oath. A promise, a pledge, an avowal. It is a vow unto the Lord, which of course makes it a very, very serious matter. A vow unto God. Notice Numbers chapter 30, verse 2. If a man vow a vow unto the Lord, or swear an oath to bind his soul with a bond, he shall not break his word, he shall do according to all that proceedeth out of his mouth. A vow unto God is a serious thing. In Deuteronomy chapter 23, Deuteronomy chapter 23, verse 21, when thou shalt vow a vow unto the Lord thy God, thou shalt not slack to pay it, for the Lord thy God will surely require it of thee, and it would be sin in thee. That is, not to keep that vow. In Ecclesiastes chapter 5, Ecclesiastes chapter 5, and verse 4. Ecclesiastes 5, verse 4. When thou vowest a vow unto God, defer not to pay it, for he hath no pleasure in fools. Pay that which thou hast vowed. And this Nazirite vow, again, we're looking at it as a picture of a life for God. And it's a vow. It's something that is very, very serious. And the life that you and I are called to live as a child of God is a very serious matter. It's a very serious matter. Now, the fact that what is before us is a vow not only speaks of the seriousness of this matter, but a vow is an undertaking. The life that we are to live is an undertaking on our behalf. But it's also a commitment. When you make a vow, you are committing yourself to something. Whatever it is that you vow to do, you are making a commitment. So this life that we are to live is an undertaking. It doesn't just happen. It's an undertaking. And it involves a commitment. It is a purpose. It is a purpose in life. And life should be a commitment to the Lord. Secondly, this not only was a very serious matter, but it involved the lay people. Notice in verse 2, it says, when either man or woman, when either man or woman. So what is before us is not something reserved for the priest, not something reserved for the Levites, those who served in the tabernacle. This was something for people that were not even called into tabernacle service. This is something that was for people who were not called to be a priest, but just ordinary men and women. It was ordinary men and women who would make this Nazirite vow. Notice thirdly that it was personal. No one could vow for another person. It was personal. And it was not legislated. It was voluntary. It was personal and it was voluntary. And the life that you and I are called to live is just that. It is personal. It is voluntary. It cannot be legislated. It is personal. It is voluntary. And we see this all through the details of this Nazirite vow. So the nouns here in verse 2, the man, a man or woman, and then the pronoun themselves, shows that this is a very personal matter. It doesn't say all the men, doesn't say all the women. But those, again, who would voluntarily take this vow, whether man or woman. Then you have the word, the verb shall, which shows that it is a not only a personal matter, but it is a voluntary matter. Again, in other words, what we have here is not something that could simply be legislated or decreed by the priests. But this was something that was the result of an inner drawing within an individual that caused them to be willing to make this vow. Now, the personal and voluntary aspect is seen all through the verses that we've read. In verses 2 and 3, you see the word themselves there in verse 2. You get himself in verse 3, and on it goes. I believe that if I counted right, there's like 35 personal pronouns from verses 2 through verse 12. So this is something that was personal. It's not something that someone could do for someone else. No one can live the Christian life for you, and you can't live it for anyone else. It is a personal matter. It's also voluntary. Again, this is not something that they were forced to do. It's evident as you read through these verses. And the willingness of this is seen, the willingness in God's service is seen throughout the Old Testament, throughout the New Testament. But Moses says in Exodus 32 and 29, consecrate. Now the very word consecrate implies something of great importance. Consecrate yourselves. That makes it personal. That's the personal aspect. 1 Chronicles 29:5, and who then is willing, voluntary, to consecrate his service this day unto the Lord? A willingness of heart is absolutely essential to living for the Lord. You cannot force someone to live for God. You can force them to go through motions. But do not mistake that for living for God. Two entirely different things. It is to be voluntary. Now, I say that as parents, when we were, most of us have already raised our children. We raised our children, we had rules, and we ought to have rules. There were rules concerning dress. There were rules concerning church. There were rules. And that's not a bad thing. But do not mistake that child's following the rules for the real thing. Don't confuse the two. You cannot legislate godliness. It's a personal matter. It's a voluntary matter. Notice in the book of Exodus chapter 35. Book of Exodus chapter 35. And verse 5. Take ye from among you an offering unto the Lord. Whosoever is of a willing heart, let him bring it. God wasn't interested in those who weren't willing. He wanted those who were of a willing heart to bring it an offering of the Lord, gold, silver, and brass. Verse 21. And they came, everyone whose heart stirred him up. So there's an inward working that leads to this willingness. And everyone whom his spirit made willing. And they brought the Lord's offering to the work of the tabernacle of the congregation and for all his service and for all the holy garments. Verse 22, and they came, both men and women, as many as were willing-hearted. And then they brought their offerings. Verse 29, the children of Israel brought a willing offering unto the Lord. Every man and woman whose heart made them willing to bring all manner of work which the Lord had commanded to be made by the hand of Moses. Now when our children were growing up, if they got some money through the week, they had to tithe on it. They weren't necessarily willing to do that, but that was a rule. It was legislated. Now, they may choose now not to. Now it's to be willing. But again, don't confuse. Don't confuse the two. What is legislated is not necessarily true service to the Lord. I'm not saying that you shouldn't have rules. Certainly you should. But don't confuse the two. And people do it all the time. They will raise their children. You've got to be in church on Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night. You don't miss church. You tithe. And then all of a sudden that child grows and they become an adult and they don't do any of those things. And you say they've fallen away from everything. No. One was legislated. It's not necessarily real. Now, they may have fallen away if it was real. But people confuse the two all the time. So the truth is this, if a person does not have within them that which makes them willing to serve the Lord, then they don't have the Spirit of God. Because the Spirit of God in us makes us willing to serve the Lord. And if the Spirit of God is not in them, you and I can't put it in them. We can't produce that. And the quicker we learn that lesson, the better off we'll be. Fourthly, the Nazarite vow, and this is the main part of the vow, involved a separation. You can't read the verses that we read without seeing that the emphasis is a separation. There's some form of the word separate in verse 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 8, and 12. You have some form of that word separate. And the words consecration and consecrate, which is a setting apart. You find that in verses 7, you find it again in verse 9, you find it again in verse 12. So you have these two words over and over. Separate or separate and consecrate or consecration. The word separate or separate conveys the idea of a disconnect, a detachment, a severance. And it also conveys the idea of a distinction, of a difference. Our lives are to be that of a distinction. Our lives are to be different. And our lives are to have a disconnect and a detachment from this world. We also see the word consecrate. To consecrate means to set apart. And again, this is something we do. We set apart ourselves. It means to reserve ourselves. It means to devote ourselves to a sacred purpose. And consecration is an absolute necessity for true separation. Now, a person can separate from many things and yet never be really set apart for the Lord. And though that can be so, that is not a true biblical separation. Biblical separation includes consecration, a setting apart, an absolutely necessary for biblical separation. So the very idea of separation and consecration implies that you and I have a personal recognition of a supreme purpose. If we do not have a supreme purpose, if we do not recognize a supreme purpose, we will not be separate and we will not be consecrated. So a purpose is a cause, and the cause is God's. A purpose is an object for which we live. It is a mission. If we have a purpose, that's our mission in life. It's our aim in life. And separation and consecration aligns with this purpose, this cause. So what is the purpose of a child of God? Well, you can break it down into a lot of different things, but it really sums up in this: glorify and honor God. That's our purpose. That's our purpose in life. 1 Corinthians 6 and verse 20, you're bought with a price, therefore glorify God in your body and in your spirit, which are God's. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 31, whether you eat or drink, whatsoever you do, do all to the glory of God. That is the basic purpose of our lives. This purpose should become our motive for living, to glorify God. It becomes our motive for living. It should be our intent. Our intent in life should simply be to glorify God. Everyone has an intent. But our intent needs to be glorify God. That ought to be our ambition. And certainly that ought to be the desire of a child of God. And that's why we read in 2 Peter 3 verse 18, to Him be glory, both now and forever. That should be our desire. That God, to God be glory, both now and forever. Today, tomorrow, forever. Our purpose does not change, or should not change. Whether we're healthy, whether we're sick, whether we're young, whether we're old, wherever we live, whatever our circumstances be, that should have no bearing upon our purpose, which is to glorify God. And the very idea of separation, the very idea of consecration is this purpose. In order to fulfill this purpose, there has to be a separation. And there has to be a consecration. I have to set myself apart for this purpose, to glorify God. So it needs to be our heart's belief and conviction that God is worthy of all glory. It will not be our purpose to glorify God until it is our conviction that He's worthy of all glory. That He is the supreme in life. Until we realize that, we will not have this purpose. And this purpose is to be so strong that it becomes our resolution in life. It becomes our joy in life to glorify God. And everything centers around this purpose. Every decision we make, every choice we make, everywhere we go, everywhere we don't go, it's all to be for the glory of God. If you can't go somewhere that does not bring glory and glorify God, then you shouldn't go there. If you can't dress in a way that does not bring glory to God, then you should not. So it all that needs to be, it needs to encompass our entire life. This purpose of glorifying God. So the Bible teaches the separation of a child of God. A separation in heart. Our hearts are to be separated from the world. There is to be a separation in thinking. We are not to think like the world. There is to be a separation in life. The way that we conduct ourselves. The way that we dress. The way that we talk. The way that we appear. There is to be a separation. The Bible very clearly teaches this separation. And I believe that the Bible gives us, unlike the rules of man, a complete picture of separated living. See, the problem with most people's concept of separation is they pick a few areas. You know, it wouldn't bother me too much to not do this anymore, so I'm not going to do that anymore. And they think they're separated. And if someone else doesn't pick that same area, well, they're worldly. The truth is, both are probably worldly. Because there's more to it. There's more to separation than just picking what we're going to separate from. Unless God is the supreme purpose, unless it is all for the glory of God, then we need to call into question what so many call separation. Every time someone says, we believe in separated living, and we do. But explain what you mean by that. Tell me what you mean by that. And most people's explanation falls far, far short of the biblical illustration of separation. Salvation itself, the very fact that God saved our soul, the grace of God teaches us. If the grace of God is in us, it teaches us to be separate. And I don't believe there's any exceptions. Titus chapter 2, verse 12, the grace of God teaching us that denying ungodliness, the grace of God that bringeth salvation teaches us to deny ungodliness. You don't have to have legislation. The grace of God teaches that. If an individual is not taught that, then you have to call into question whether the grace of God is operative in their life. Because the grace of God teaches us to deny ungodliness, worldly lust, that we should live soberly, righteously, and godly in this present world. So, just the very saving grace of God teaches us that we're to be a separate people. That we're to be a separate people. Now, notice what this separation involves here in the Nazirite vow. And we've touched on these things in past and other messages. But notice the phrase, unto the Lord. Verse 2, toward the end of the verse there, to separate themselves unto the Lord. Verse 5, he separateth himself unto the Lord. Verse 6, he separateth himself unto the Lord. Verse 8, all the days of his separation he is holy unto the Lord. Verse 12, and he shall consecrate unto the Lord. And again, this is personal and it is voluntary. The grace of God in us, the Spirit of God dwelling in us, stirs us to separate ourselves unto the Lord. This is what is taught in Romans 12, verse 1, though very rarely emphasized. Present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable, unto God. So you see, there is a separation unto the Lord. And I believe that's the foundation of true separation. Because you can separate from without separating unto the Lord. And if that's the case, if all you do is separate from and not separate unto, that's not biblical separation. So there has to be this unto the Lord. Now notice, verse 2, separate unto the Lord, comes before what is said in verse 3, he shall separate himself from. And likewise in Romans chapter 12, verses 1 and 2. We are to present our bodies a living sacrifice unto the Lord. And that comes before, be ye not conformed to this world. So this separation unto the Lord, which most people completely ignore, is really the foundation of separating from. So what is this separation unto? Well, it's consecration. It's setting ourselves apart for Him. Separation is to be apart. It is consecration, setting ourselves apart from Him. We can make a list of things that we're not going to do and not ever come close to being set apart for the Lord. So we must first, and I believe if we set ourselves apart for the Lord, the next logical thing is to separate from. That's why these two go together. They go together. There is a significant order. Separate unto, separate from. So let's look at what the Nazarite vow involved in separating from. Verse 3. He shall separate himself from. And there were three basic areas of prohibition. Three basic areas that he or she were to separate from. In verse 3 and 4, he shall separate himself from wine and strong drink, and shall drink no vinegar. The fermentation process of wine or vinegar of strong drink. Neither shall he drink any liquor of grapes, that's the juice, nor eat moist grapes or dried. All the days of his separation he shall eat nothing that is made of the vine tree, from the kernels even to the husks. Now I do not believe that these verses, I don't believe it's the purpose of these verses to argue in the direction of prohibiting alcohol. Now let me explain. There are plenty other verses that do that. There are plenty other verses that do that. But I don't believe that's the intent of this verse. And anyone who, I cringe anytime someone is trying to preach or teach or convince someone that they shouldn't drink and they turn to this. Well, you've got a problem. If you use this as a prohibition against alcohol, and again, please don't misunderstand me, alcohol is prohibited. Other verses teach that. That's not our intent tonight. If you want to just take, he shall separate himself from wine and strong drink, you've got to take the rest of it as well. You've got to take the rest of it as well. And he shall not drink any liquor of grapes. So if you're going to use this verse to prohibit alcohol, then grape juice is also prohibited, if that's what you're going to use it for. And not only that, he's not to eat grapes, whether it be moist or dry. So if you're going to use this verse to argue against alcohol, again, use other verses. There's plenty of other verses that do that. But if you're going to use this verse, then be consistent and don't drink grape juice and don't eat moist grapes or dried grapes. Everybody even goes further. He shall eat nothing that is made of the vine tree. Nothing. So it's obvious here that the intent of this verse, and we have to keep explaining ourselves, the intent is not the prohibition of alcohol. That's not the intent. Again, we keep saying there are other verses that teach that. Use those verses. Don't use this verse for that purpose. So you have this wine and strong drink, which is all intoxicating drink, no vinegar, the fermentation of wine and vinegar. Also mentioned is the liquor of grapes, nor eat moist grapes or dried. In verse 4, there's mention again made of the vine, nothing of the vine tree, referring to the inside and the husk, the inside and the outside of the grape. So the question has to be asked, what is wrong? What is wrong with the vine? Nothing. Nothing. What is wrong with the grapes? Nothing. What is wrong with the kernel or the husks? Nothing. Nothing is wrong with these things. But in the Nazarite vow, they were to separate from them. In fact, all of these things were common. And for the most part, they were enjoyable things. There's a principle here. There's a very valuable lesson for you and I to learn. In ancient Israel, these things that, again, they vowed to separate from here, were the good things of the land. They were the good things of the land, the vine, the grapes. So the emphasis of this portion of the Nazarite vow is, my purpose is to glorify God. And sometimes that means I have to avoid even some of the good things of life. People ask all the time, well, what is wrong with it? If it gets in the way of serving God, everything. There may not be anything wrong with it per se. So in this Nazarite vow, we are taught that we have to even separate from things that are not necessarily wrong for the purpose of glorifying God. We have to separate from even the good things in order that I can focus upon the best thing, which is the Lord. That principle is taught in fasting also. So concerning the Nazarite vow, the Nazarite vow was usually for a set time period. It wasn't usually a lifetime thing. It was for a set time period that one would take this vow. And there should be times in our life when we, as a child of God, separate ourselves from everything. Not just that which is wrong, but everything, in order to focus completely upon the Lord. And that's the whole idea of fasting. I'm not going to eat so I can pray. That's spiritual fasting. So the emphasis of this portion of the vow is that even the good things of life are times to be separated from, in order that we can fully consecrate ourselves to the things of the Lord. Again, it goes back to a separating unto the Lord. Notice verse 5. This portion of the Nazarite vow involves the hair. Now, if you're going to, again, use this as an argument against drinking, again, I'll say it again, there are other verses that do that. But if you're going to use this verse, this portion of Scripture has an argument against drinking, then you're also making an argument for long hair. You're also making that argument because it's in the context. No razor come upon his head, and he shall let the locks of the hair of his head grow. It's part of the Nazarite vow concerning a man or a woman. They were to grow their hair. They were not to cut it. Now, for a woman, that's fine. And not so for a man. But hair rituals, why would the Lord tell them to grow their hair out? Why would the Lord do that? Well, hair rituals were very common in pagan cultures that surrounded Israel. Pagans would shave their heads as a sign of devotion to their false gods. The emphasis of this portion of the Nazarite vow is identify yourself with God. Don't shave your head like the pagans do for their false gods. You let your hair grow. In other words, identify yourself with God. Mark your devotion to God by not looking and acting like the heathen world. That's the principle that is being taught here. And that is a New Testament principle. So this portion of the Nazarite vow manifests an open profession and a willingness to accept reproach for identifying ourselves with the Lord and being devoted to God. That is what it means to have a life for God. You have to be willing to be identified with God no matter what it's going to cost you. No matter how many people laugh, no matter how many people mock, no matter how many people reproach you, you are going to be identified with God. That's the principle of the Nazarite vow. Verses 6 and 7, the Nazarite vow involves contact or no contact with that which defiles. They were not to come into contact with a dead body. Whether it was, you read verse 6 and 7, whether it was their father, their mother, their brother, their sister, it didn't matter. They had to separate themselves from that which was defiling, even if it was in their own family. This is a principle that many have never grasped. Well, it's a family reunion, and you know, I've got to be a witness. Even if it's your own family, if it defiles, stay away from it. If it defiles you spiritually, if it brings you down spiritually, if it causes you to think in a worldly way, stay away from it. It doesn't matter if it's father, mother, brother, sister, aunt, uncle, grandma, grandpa. It doesn't matter. There's no exceptions here. So we see here that if a person has taken a Nazarite vow, their father or their mother passes away, they are not to touch that body because they'll be defiled. They'll be defiled. So this separation from includes everything that would defile. There are many people that we have to separate from because they do not help us spiritually. And we would be wise to just separate from them. I'm not saying mistreat them. I'm not saying to be mean to them. I'm saying we cannot court their friendship and desire to be with them because they defile us. And then the Nazarite vow involved the dealing with personal defilement. If you became defiled, you had to deal with it. And we see that in verse 8. All the days of a separation, he is holy unto the Lord. That's inward. That is outward. It is unto, and it is from. So it is of extreme importance regarding the separation of the Nazarite vow that when defilement came into the life of an individual that had taken this vow, he had to deal with that defilement. And you have the details of that in verses 9 through 12. We're not going to read that because we've run out of time. But in the case of defilement, there was a ceremony, verses 9 through 12. There was a ceremony of cleansing in which his head would be shaved on the seventh day. This individual has grown his hair. But now his head would be shaved on the seventh day, and on the eighth day he was to offer two doves and two pigeons as a sin offering and the other as a burnt offering. In other words, his separation started all over. It started all over. And that is made clear in verse 12. But the days that were before shall be lost because his separation was defiled. We can separate from, we cannot do certain things, not go to certain places, and we can be defiled, and we do not take care of that defilement. We are not a separated people. You start over. Once we're defiled, the whole process starts over. In other words, you cannot ignore, the principle is this, you cannot ignore sin. If we're going to have a life for God, we cannot ignore sin. Jesus brought this out very clearly in Matthew 15, verse 8, Matthew 23, verse 25, 26, and 27. Talking about just making the outside look good while there's defilement within. So, if we become defiled, and we will, separation, the whole separation process starts over. It starts over. You can't just continue on. It has to start over. So defilement undoes separation. It undoes it. That is taught in the Nazarite vow. So therefore, the defilement has to be dealt with if we are going to be truly, truly separated. So the principles set forth in the Nazarite vow should characterize the life of a child of God. It is a picture of a life for the Lord. It involves, again, you cannot read these verses without seeing the emphasis upon separation and consecration. One cannot live a life for God without this separation, without this consecration. We're not here to fit in. We're not here to fit in with the world. We're not here to even gain the friendship of the world. That's not why we're here. God saved our souls, and He's left us here on this earth that we might glorify Him. And that requires a separation. First, a separation unto God, and which will lead to a separation from. And the world will not understand. And family will not understand. But that's not our purpose in life. Our purpose in life is not to get them to understand. Our purpose in life is to glorify God. And you hope that one day, that God will show it to them and they will understand. But this life requires true separation. And most of what is called separation in religion today is not true biblical separation. It's not the whole picture that the Bible so very clearly paints for us, the big picture of separation. God help us to be a separated people, a people set apart for God, a people whose ambition is to glorify the Lord, a people whose intent in life is to glorify God. That means that there are going to be times where I have to go against family, where you have to go against friends. People say all the time, well, that's my family. That has nothing to do with it. That has nothing to do with the purpose of glorifying God. Nothing. And we need to realize that. Most of us sitting here tonight have separated. And we've practiced separation even in our families. And we know that there is a cost. But we don't lose anything. We really don't. You don't lose by serving God. You gain by serving God. You always do. Oh, you might think you've lost a friend, but God will give you 10 others. You might think you've lost a brother or sister in a family relationship, but God will give you brothers and sisters in abundance. You don't lose. You don't lose by living this life that is pictured here in the Nazarite vow. Brother Tim, if you'd come and lead us verse 6.